The fact that he left it behind means it's ein dato lachzor. That's it. If he was running away, that would be one thing. But if they left in time of peace and they leave the avodah zarah behind, the assumption is they're not interested and it's batel. B'shas milchama, the Mishnah says, is asura, because b'shas milchama, he's fleeing, but his intent is to come back and get his idol. Then the Mishnah says, b'mosios shamalachim, harei elu mutaros, m'nei shemamidin osam b'shah shamalachim ofrim. So a bimos, which maybe it's not clear, I think our word for bima is this Greek word. I don't think it's the word bama, but I think this is the Greek word of bimos. So if these bimoseos, Rashi explains, were stones that were hewn, and when the king would pass by or the emperor would pass by, they'd have the stone with an avodah zarah set up on top of it. So in effect, the bimos is meant as a mishamesh for avodah zarah. It's something that serves the functions with the avodah zarah.
By the way, Dinstaus calls this pedestals.
Okay. Platform. It's a platform. So the Mishnah says it's mutaros. So the question is, it seems to be very strange, because the Mishnah, what is the reason for the Mishnah? The reason for the Mishnah sounds like, if I were to tell you, the reason that bimasos are pedestals that they set up to put avodah zarah on when they worship when the kings pass through. So is that a reason why a bimos should be permitted? Why a bimos should be usher? What would you say?
Usher.
It should be usher. So the mission, the presentation of the mission is very odd. You're giving me the reason why it shouldn't be permitted, not a reason why it should be permitted. So the Gemara is going to deal with that. But that's what the Gemara says. Then that's what the Mishnah says. So the Gemara begins. Amar Rabbi Yirmiyah bar Abba Amar Rav. Beis Nimrod, harehi kavo das kochavim. So this is kind of interesting. I would say it's historic. It is halacha lemaisa for them, but only presumably if you could identify where Beis Nimrod is. There is actually there's a Gemara in Chelek about this, a particular location that the Gemara describes how it serves to cause people to forget. It's, I wouldn't say a segula, that's not the right word, but for forgetfulness. Of course, the idea being that this is where everybody forgot forgot how to talk to each other. Right? That was where the bilbul all took place. So the Gemara talks about how one third of the tower got burned, one third got knocked down, one third is still standing. So they had a place. I suspect the slight skeptic in it, if I'm permitted to say so, it tends to believe this is kind of like, you know, when you go to Israel and when the tour guides tell you, oh, that's the grave of so and so, you know, it's like, yeah, okay, very nice. Yeah. So it's always possible something might be buried there, but for all we know, it's a donkey. So the bottom line is, I suspect that Beis Nimrod is the same thing. But they had a place that they identified. This was the base of Migdal Bafel. So he says that Beis Nimrod harei kavodas kochavim shenichua over b'shas shalom umotar. It's like an avodah zarah. The assumption, of course, here. Is that Migdal Bava was made for avodah zarah purposes, right? There are different theories in the Medrash as to what the goal of the builders was. One of them, of course, was to, you know, were the atheists who believed that every 1500 years or so, the supports of the heavens become weak and the water just pours out, right? Based upon the ancient cosmological theory of that the sky was solid and it held the water up. So they decided they were going to go build supports for the heaven. That's why they built this tower. And of course, there were other theories. They were going to fight against God. And then there was a third theory that they were going to set up an avodah zarah on top of it. So this seems to be working with that theory. So Rashi just says, Beis Nimrod is a Migdal Shabanu Dor HaPalaga Lavodas Kochavim. And Nimrod was the king upon them. So was their king? So it's called Beis Nimrod. So he says that it's, Rabbi Yirmiyah says in the name of Rav, that it's like an avodah zarah that the owners left b'shas shalom, and it's permitted. Why? Because afal gav d'chi badrinu rachmana kishas milcham adami. Even though when God came down and he scattered them, the word badrinu is the same word as the Hebrew pazar. The bays and the pay are the same sound, and the dal and zayin are often switched between Hebrew and Aramaic. So God scattered them, badrinu rachmana, even though that was like war, they went to fight war with God, and God fought back. Nonetheless, since in the interim, Ibau Lemedar, if they wanted to return later, Hadur, they could have come back. Midalo Hadur Batule Batle. The fact that they didn't come back later to worship the Avodah Zarah, to claim the Avodah Zarah, indicates that was Bittul. They got the message from God. Okay, fine. So the next time you happen to be traveling in Iraq and you want to go visit Beis Nimrod, it's perfectly fine. Next.
So this makes a kula for the Bishas Milchama.
Correct. So
in other words, that even now it turns out that even Bishas Milchama could be mutar.
Correct.
If they don't come back.
Given the circumstances, right.
Because
right.
The Mishnah, that's like making the Mishnah a little more. It's changing what's in the Mishnah level.
Well, again, the Mishnah, I think the assumption behind the Mishnah, the Mishnah distinguishes between Shas Milchama and Shas Shalom because one of them, the assumption is they left it behind by choice. One, they left it behind not by choice and doesn't constitute a bittul. But if they left it behind not by choice but now had the choice to return, so that's all the Gemara says. Yeah, yes, you're correct. It's qualifying that, but it's fairly, it's not a terribly big chiddush.
So it isn't, I mean, you keep contributing to their intention. Why can't it just be? Why don't we just look at their behavior? Why do you keep like? Who cares what they?
Well, we are.
If you turn your back on something, if you turn your, it's even with sailing also. You know, you made a distinction that when he sells it, he's mevatel it. It's not so much that he's. Who cares what he's thinking? It's the behavior that we're interested in. And this is if you alienate an object.
But if you think about the Gemara's analysis of the previous Mishnah, the sale itself is subject to what his intent is. It's not all sales,
No, when the behavior is selling it to someone who melts it down, that behavior is deemed alienating it. We don't really care. Another example: if you break the nose off, he said, right? That's mevatel. Who cares what he's thinking while he's breaking it? Breaking it, we look at the behavior, and that's what.
Okay. What I would say is bittul doesn't have to take place only when they flee. And I would even argue that flee itself, you're not even doing anything to the Avodah Zarah. Fleeing, you're just leaving it behind. What does that mean? So in other words, there's no maisa to the Avodah Zarah. The reason why fleeing Bishas Shalom, or leaving Bishas Shalom, leave it behind, is by not taking it, you're showing what you're thinking. You're showing, I'm not interested in this Avodah Zarah anymore. So by the same token...
Is that a bittul?
Yeah.
Why is that a bittul?
The Gemara assumes that a bittul does not have to be an act of bittul with pat. Once the guy has decided, I don't worship this anymore, in a very definite way...
I don't take it, it's not the same thing as I don't worship it. He left it behind for whatever reason. Who knows why he left it behind?
But the Gemara is assuming that means I'm not interested in worshiping. That's in the Mishnah already.
That's not intention. But then that's a behavior then. It's turning your back on your... Let's say it's too heavy, that's why I didn't take it.
Again, the question is, does he intend to worship it or not? That's the issue. Sometimes...
Well, why does he have to... Just because he doesn't intend to worship something doesn't mean he's mevatel it. He left it behind, but he's not mevatel it.
What it means, he no longer worships it. That's all.
An idol doesn't require a constant input. You made it an idol. You worshipped it once. You made it an idol. It doesn't need like
Mahadish Batu. What you see from the Gemara is that it's not so.
The idol?
You see from the Gemara it's not so. That once the guy is...
Every day you have to go down to the idol?
No, but as long as the assumption is by default, I intend to continue to worship it, which is because, look, you can't worship it every second of the day. So let's say I take an hour break. We don't say, I'm not worshipping that hour. But once a person seems to have made decision going forward without any time limit that they're not going to worship
it's
anymore.
If something is designated to be, holy, whether you leave it behind, whether you take it with you,
there's no bittul for kutchin.
Yeah, right. Okay, I'm saying,
kutcher requires
tigyon, but metaphysical
you
way
can't. I cannot
transforming an object.
Sam, I can't be mokdish an animal, mm-hmm. And now I see, and I'm now going to declare it batel. It doesn't work.
No, I mean,
but
Avodah Zarah analogy, I'm just saying a metaphysical transformation doesn't need a constant renewal of what you've transformed with in the beginning.
I grant that, but if there's a terminal point, if you've done something or made it clear in your mind that you're done with it, that is when not by hektish, it doesn't work. Even if I get up and say I don't want this to be hektish anymore.
I don't mean to make too much of that analogy.
Okay,
I'm just saying that when you designate something, it remains that way. It's a big cool, in other words.
Let's move on. Okay. Correct. Okay. So now the Gemara deals with the problem of Bimoseo Shemalachim Harei Lemutaros. The Chimit Neishim Amidanosa B'Shah Shemalachim Over Mutarim. What do you mean? If they set it up as a platform for Avodah Zarah, it makes it Misham She Avodah Zarah at certain times. Why is it that it's mutar? So the Gemara says, Amar Rabba Bar Chana Amar Rabbi Yochanan Hachi Kamar Neishim Amidanosa B'Shah Shemalachim Overim. The reason, in the first place, the whole purpose of the Bimos is because sometimes the kings pass through and they're going to worship there. However, and many times, manichem derech zo v'holchem b'derech acheres. In other words, the king, he didn't come this way, right? You don't know which way the Pope was going to pass, right? Everybody was hoping he was going to come down their block, but it didn't come down the block. So what does that mean? So Rashi writes, "Mahalchem b'derech acheres ve'en choshishin lohem." In other words, they just ignore it. Hilkoch la b'sham shevo des kochav m'chashivi. Apparently, and it's very interesting, in other words, it's not, Rashi doesn't draw a distinction. Let's say the king did go down that path. Let's say the king did go down that path. So then, is that different? They set up the Avodah Zarah, but presumably once the king left, they took the Avodah Zarah away. So my assumption is that once they take the Avodah Zarah away, then of course it's going to be mutter. The question is, that in effect is a kind of bittul. But the question was, if they set it up to put an Avodah Zarah on it, so why isn't that Misham? Well, the problem is that Misham Shevo Dazar only usher once you only usher once it's actually been worshipped. So I guess, and Rashi has explained further, but it so it sounds from Rashi that Rashi sounds like it's not called Misham Shevo Dazar at all. In other words, because it's only provisional, it's only conditional, it doesn't really count as Misham Sheva Dezara. Tosus says differently. Tosus says that the priest, Tosus writes the bottom Tosus, V'holchem b'derech acheres, v'akomarim she'avadum, lo asom avodas kochavim, el letzorach ha'malachim, u'chasheroim she'en ha'malachim choshishin lahem, gam heim v'at l'nosam. So what Tosus says is that that it's conditional. It's conditional, and once it's not, but only it sounds like if it's not used. Right. In other words, if you have the Bima Sos, and this one wasn't used, then the priests themselves say, okay, we're Mevatel, we don't actually care about it. Whereas for Rashi, it sounds somewhat different. For Rashi, it sounds like they're not Misham Shevo Dezara in the first place. Anything which, when you make it in the first place, is really provisional and really conditional, it doesn't even acquire the status of Misham Shevo Dezara. And there is an advantage to Rashi's commentary, because according to Tosfos, it's not clear why you need bittul. If you set something up as Misham Shei Avodah Zarah and nobody actually worships the Avodah Zarah, so it's not usur. It's only once it's worshipped that the Misham Shem become prohibited as well. According to Rashi, at least you understand that the whole argument being made here is that I would say that even if they set up the Avodah Zarah on it, it still doesn't constitute Misham Shei Avodah Zarah, because it's really, I guess it doesn't have chashivas. It's actually not that important. And you see that often they don't bother to use it. So that's what it sounds like from Rashi. Okay, so now the Gemara continues. Ki asa ula yosef abimasa pagima. Ula, I don't know where ula came out of. He came to Eretz Yisrael. He sat down on a bimus, which the assumption was aser b'hana, but it was pagum. It had chipped. It gotten damaged. Amar le Rav Yehuda l'ula. Rav Yehuda says to ula, v'ha rav u'shmol da'amri tarvayo bimus shenifgam is aser. Rav and Shmuel both said that a bimos that got damaged, that part of the piece split off. And remember, you have to think about this, compare it to a mizbeach. When our mizbeach is nifgam, a mizbeach is psula. In other words, you can't bring karbanos on it when a mizbeach is pagum. So Rav and Shmuel said that a bimos shenifgam is still considered a bimos. It's still prohibited b'hana. So Omar le Rav Yehuda. V'afil l'man da Omar ain ovdim l'shvarim. Hani mili avodas kochavim dezila beimilsa lemiflach l'shvarim. Even according to the opinion of the Gemara, that when you have broken things of avodah zarah, meaning not that the guy smashed it broke on its own, even the opinion that says that avodah zarah she nishvar is mutar b'hana, that we assume that bittul works automatically. This goes back to a long time ago, Reish Lakish's opinion. That's only true. That's true when it comes to Avodah Zarah. Why? Because if it's a broken Avodah Zarah, it's pasnish to worship it. It's like it's degrading. How do you worship this thing? Aval hai, if the bimos has a little pagam in it, so lo ichbaslei, it's not such a big deal. For us, so for mizbeach shnifgam, it's possible. For them, if it's a pedestal for an Avodah Zarah, it's still a pedestal. Okay, so it's got a little chip in it. So Amar Lei, Ula got upset at Rav Yehuda. He said, "Man yahiv me afra the Rabu Shmuel umal inan ayenin." Literally, it's the words would mean, if only we could give us from the dirt of Rav and Shmuel and fill in. I think it's your eyes, actually, the eyes. I think euphemistically, ayenin probably means my eyes or our eyes. Ula was not happy with the statement. He said, HaRav Yochanan Reish Lakish to Amitavayu, Bima Shenifgam is Mutter. They said, no, contrary. Bima Shenifgam is Mutter. V'afilu l'man da'omar ovdim l'shvarim, hani midli avodas kochavim. That's only true if you want to say they worship, even according to the Madamar, that Shivra Avodah Zara, which broke on its own, is prohibited by Na. That's only because they worship that. Why? Since they worshipped it already, they don't want to be mevatel it. You know, like we say, luchos v'shivrei luchos munachim ba'aron. We treat even the shivrei luchos, the broken luchos, we treat them with kedush as well. So they worship the Avodah Zara. It broke, unless they actively broke it. So it's pasnish to treat it, you know, without respect. Abot, avalhani, shaklu lahai, umaisi bimus acharina. A bimus, it's just a pedestal. It's not like it's the Avodah Zarah itself. So basically, what you really have here is Ula, kiasa has to be to Babel. And there's a machlokas between Babel and Eretz Yisrael here. And Rabbi Yehuda was presenting the Babylonian perspective, and Ula just got upset at him. He wasn't interested in hearing, and he said, Rabbi Yochanan Reish Lakish from Eretz Yisrael, that's where Ula lived. Ula was one of the people who made Aliyah. So Ula said, that's what we follow. And then the Gemara quotes, a proof to this, Tanya Kavased Rabbi Yochanan Reish Lakish, Bimos Shenifgam Mutar. A Bimos, which was broken, you're allowed to get Hana from. Mizbeach Shenifgam is Asur Ad Sheinotates Rubo. So a Mizbeach, the difference between a Bimos and a Mizbeach, is the Bimos is something that's just a pedestal for Avodah Zarah. But a Mizbeach, you already bring sacrifices on, so there, a Mizbeach Shenifgam is Asur until a majority of it is broken. So for the purposes of proving what we wanted to prove, the Braisa says that a Bimos that gets damaged, that's it. You're allowed to get Hana from it.
Removing the idol from it? Why doesn't that matter?
No, so I think the assumption is as long as it's still, you know, pristine, they're happy to use it. Once it's nifgam, that's a different story. You know, absent an act of bittul.
I was going to say, why is that a good comparison? Why would you compare a bimos to a mizbeach? Because a bimos is just a pedestal, right? The mizbeach is the...
Well, you don't worship the mizbeach, but you worship on it.
On it. Okay.
And you're putting it's instrumental to the worship in a way that the bimos is not. But that's exactly... But that's exactly why the distinction is drawn. Yeah. Right? In other words, the bimos is not so holy to them.
Right?
In other words, you think about the structure. Avodah Zarah, Shivrei Avodah Zarah, are still asar.
Right.
Mizbeach, you need a majority to be broken, then it's mutter. Bimos, shenifkam is mutter, right? Notice it follows a consistent pattern, that the greater holiness that's invested in something, the more of it that you need to break in order to assume bittul. So that, it fits. In other words, mizbeach and bimos are not treated the same way.
Right.
But they're compared in the sense that they're stages moving away from Avodah Zarah. Okay, so hechi dami bimus, hechi dami mizbeach. Amar Yaakov bar Idi, Amar Yochanan, bimus even achas, mizbeach is avanim harbe, which is a distinction that may be familiar to you, more classically presented as the difference between a matzeva and a mizbeach. The matzeva, which Chazal say was beloved in the days of the patriarchs, we find that that both Avram, I think. Certainly Yaakov set up a matzeva. I remember Avram also did, but it was considered ahuva bimei ha'avos, but then the Torah prohibited use of matzeva after Matan Torah because it had become a chok of the Canaanites. It became a practice of the Canaanites, but mizbeach, I mean, the truth is they also used mizbeachs as well, but if you prohibited a matzeva and you prohibited a mizbeach, you'd have nothing left on which to bring karbanos. Okay. I know the Rambam and the Mora would say, but God could have prohibited karbanos also, but in the Rambam's view and the Mora Nevuchim is that He wanted to help wean them off idolatry, therefore he had karbanos. So he left the mizbeach intact, but not a bimos.
Right, so then, are they both being used for karbanos? Because matzeva is used for karbanos.
Matzeva, not bimos. Yeah. Not bimos. So matzeva would have been used for karbanos.
So will there be karbanos after Messianic time? According to Rambam?
Yes. The Rambam and the Mishnah Torah says absolutely.
He says clearly?
Yes. Yes. The Rambam's definition of a Mashiach, I put it this way. If the Rambam, this is a very simple proof. If the Rambam didn't believe that we'd bring Karbanos again, so then he wouldn't have had a whole, you know, the Rambam doesn't have any sections in Mishnah Torah that deal with the Horah Shah, mitzvah l'shah. Only mitzvah l'doros. So, yes. I know that
the Torah to me a couple of weeks ago, I looked at it at Shabbos afternoon and said the Rambam, clearly the Rambam, that according to him, the Rambam would say there was no Karbanos.
Yes, I'll
show it to you. The Torah to me.
Okay, Okay. But despite what he says in the Mora, there are a lot of, and there's there, if you were to follow that logic, it's not just Karbanos that wouldn't apply. There are lots of prohibitions of the Torah that Rambam ties to Avodah Zarah of those times. And if you're going to argue, well, those times no longer exist anymore, there's no longer that Avodah Zarah, then Shatnei should become permitted, Basar B'chalav should become permitted, and so on. So I don't think the Rambam actually held that way. Omar Chizkiya.
Let me just clarify Matseva. Matseva is just a slab of stone.
A single stone.
A single stone. So let's say Bayako, he didn't bring a carbon there, right? He anointed it, right?
Well, that's what he poured a libation, right?
Where do you see in Chumash that they used the Matseva as a carbon, to bring a carbon?
Where do you see, so I presume Kies Mizbecho Sam Tito Tzon Ves Matseva Sam right? These are all things that are used in somehow in idolatrous worship. So the Asherah tree they worship probably under, and the Mizbeach clay they worshipped on. I presume that's the same. Yeah, I mean, at least when the Gemara defines it, it just says Matzeh. It gives the exact same definition as it distinguishes here between Bimos and Mizbeach, but here Bimos and Mizbeach have two different functions. So the Gemara continues on the top of Nundal Ramad Aleph. Amar Chizkiya, Mikra. What's the pasuk that draws a distinction between bimus and mizbeach in terms of the breaking? So he says, "Besumo kol avnei mizbeach ka avnei kir gir menupatzos layakumu asherim v'chamanim." He takes a pasuk from Isaiah, which speaks about how God is going to, let's say, destroy, or through his agent, destroy the idolatry. When he places all the stones of the mizbeach, like Avnei Gir, Gir Rashi says is frost, Kfor, Menupatzos, smashed, Lo Yakumu Asherim V'Chamanim, no Asheras or sun idols, Chamanim, will be set up. So the way Chizkiya reads the pasuk is, Iika Ka'avnei Gir Menupatzos, if the Mizbeach has been smashed, like Avnei Gir, meaning it's no longer a majority intact, then Lo Yakumun Asherim V'Chamanim, but V'ilav, Yakumu, but otherwise they will actually set it up. Obviously, Chizkiya's pasuk is what we call an asmachta. It's just he's using it as kind of a hint to reflect the reality, at least as Avodah Zarah was worshipped then. Tosas here has a very interesting comment about Chizkiya. If you look at the top Tosos, if you look at the sequence of the Gemara before you look at Tosos, so first the Gemara said. Quoted a brisa that said that a bimos shenifkam is mutar, but a mizbeach which is nifkam is prohibited until a majority is broken. Then Rabbi Yochanan explained the difference between bimos and a mizbeach, and then Chizkiya quotes a pasuk to explain that by a mizbeach until it is broken into many, many, many tiny stones. Now the truth is, one could have figured out on his own to what is Chizkiya responding. What is he commenting on, qualifying, or proving? Which of the preceding statements? Well, the sequence is Rabbi Yochanan, but Rabbi Yochanan made a claim, the Braisa claim that a Mizbeach is prohibited until it's broken more than a majority. So Chizkiya, now Rabbi Yochanan just described what is a Mizbeach, what is a Matseva. So logically speaking, when you think about it, it only makes sense Chizkiya is going in the Braisa, but Tosus goes further. He says, Tzarech Lomar, the Chizkiya Abaraisa Koi. Chizkiya is commenting on the Braisa, Velo al Devar Rabbi Yochanan. Now why? Sharei Chizkiya Rabo Shar Rabbi Yochanan. So Chizkiya was Rabbi Yochanan's Rebbe, so it's kind of odd to be working in that direction. Okay, fine. So there are other ways of dealing with it, but nonetheless, that's the simple, and the truth is, in this particular case, there's no reason to go further, because when you just think about logically what Chizkiya was, what he proved from the Pasuk, so it actually was what was said in the Braisa, not was Rabbi Yochanan's statement. Okay, so that is the end of this section of the Gemara. And now we're going to begin what is a very, very interesting and somewhat complicated presentation of the Gemara with respect to a question that we've explored before, the question of Ne'avad, an object that was worshipped, and at least it's going to start out with an animal that's worshipped. So if there's one thing that we might remember from previously, is that if a person worships an animal, the animal becomes not asur b'hanah, but you can't bring it as a karban. Right, now, and the assumption we made until now, and we probably still will make, is that it's only true if it's your animal. If it's somebody else's animal and you worship it, so the rule is that ein adam oser davar she'eino shelo. A person cannot make prohibited something that doesn't belong to him or her. And it's with that, and that's where the Gemara is now going to launch into a discussion under what conditions that is true. However, in order to properly deal with this Gemara, we're in order to make even heads or tails, because it's very difficult, we have to take a little detour to a topic that I think we've touched upon a little bit, but not in depth before, but I thought that this would be sort of an appropriate time to deal with. And that is the topic of martyrdom. When I say by martyrdom, I don't mean the historical martyrdom, but the obligation of sacrificing one's life when confronted with having to avoid violating certain laws of the Torah. And it's going to be central, and I would start by saying the following. There is a central question that I would guess, I don't know if secular law has its parallel. I mean, some of the things are parallel, but we have a concept in halacha that onus rachmana patre, that when a person does something, when they have no choice, when it's done under duress, the Torah exempts them. The source for this, and the Gemara is going to quote this, is the parsha in the section in the Sedra of Kisetze, when the betrothed Nara, the betrothed maiden, is raped. So if she is raped in the field where no one, where the assumption is she was consenting, or because calling out or her silence doesn't prove anything because there would have been nowhere there to help her that she would have expected her to call out, the Torah says v'lanara lo saseh davar, you shouldn't do anything to the nara, ein lanara chet maves, she has no sin, no liability for death, ki kasher yakum ish areeu rutzacho nefesh kein hadavar hazeh. Because just as a person gets up and ambushes and kills his friend, so too this is the same thing. It means that she, obviously, when someone gets, as a general rule, there are weird exceptions in the world, but as a general rule, when one person rises up against another to kill that person, it's not with the consent or the wishes of the person who was killed. It's against their will. They had no choice in the matter. Somehow this is compared to that as well. Which is kind of interesting. It's an odd comparison, and it caught Chazal's attention. And two very major principles, and not in the direction you necessarily would have expected it, are learned, as we're going to see, from this comparison. This is a hekesh between murder and gilei arayos and prohibited sexual relations. And the Gemara learns one thing from one to the other, and another thing from the other to the one. What it learns from Nara Hamorasa to Rotseach is that by Nara Hamorasa, the Torah says that she's exempt. Tzo'aka ha-na'ara ha-ma'orasa ve'ein moshi'ala. She cried out, or could have cried out, but no one was there to help her. And the Gemara comments in Sanhedrin, ha-yesh moshi'ala, if there's someone there who could help her, he can help her in any way necessary, including killing the person who's attempting to rape her. From this we learn, not the way you would have expected, that just as by Nara Hamarasa, you're allowed to kill the person who's attempting to rape the Nara Hamarasa, so too, if a person is trying to kill a fellow human being, you are allowed to kill that person in order to save the person who's endangered. That's the source for the law of the Good Samaritan, being allowed to kill the pursuer. We would have thought that the origin actually begins with murder because it's intuitive. It's not. It starts with Nara Hamarasa. And, in the reverse, the Gemara learns from that, we'll read this in a moment, just as when it comes to murder, you're not allowed to kill somebody else to save your life, just as we say, and again, not a person who's threatening you, but any other case where you're not being threatened by the person, so too, gilei arayos, you're not allowed to violate even if it's going to cost your life. Right? Just as rotseach is a hereg v'al yavar, so too gilei arayos is a hereg v'al yavar. How do we know that Rotseach is Yehorik Yavar? How do you know you're not allowed to kill somebody else to save your own life? So, which is perhaps one of those powerful statements of rabbinic thought. There's no source for it. It's a svara. It's a logic. It's a piece of logic, which is Maichosis. Maichosis de dama di dach sumak tve, dilma dama di de sumak tve. Who says that your blood is redder than his blood? Maybe his blood is redder than yours. And therefore, you are not allowed to kill someone who is not endangering your life. You are not allowed to kill them in order to save your life. If someone puts a gun to your head and says, kill so-and-so, or I'm going to kill you, The answer is you give up your life rather than kill so-and-so. In a more practical way, to the extent that if you're dealing with a person where this matters in halacha, this is not a, it's not a, I mean, I won't say it never happens, but it's not the typical case of the story the Gemara tells of the guy who came to the Amora and said that Mara de Roy, the Mara de Asra, not the rabbi, but the different Mara de Asra who had power, told me, kill so-and-so, or I'm going to kill you, what should I do? And he was told no. So that's obviously not a terribly common, I won't say never happens, not a terribly common occurrence. What is a much more common issue is in the field of medical ethics. If you deal with a situation, for example, of a person who is halachically speaking not dead, but let's say totally incapacitated, so we wouldn't say that you're allowed to, let's say, take the organs from such a person, which in the process you would end up killing them because you're going to save another life. You might even save multiple lives, but you're not allowed, assuming that the person is halachically still alive, and even if the person gave permission to take those organs from the person would be an act of murder, and even though it's being done to save somebody else's life, it's still prohibited. Marshall.
I'm just curious. Has there been any halachic writing on the sort of famous various trolley car ethical questions, where it's sort of one versus five, and actively throwing someone onto the tracks to divert the trolley car to save the five?
I don't.
Pulling the switch, because these are all very...
Yeah, it's been there. This has been written about. This has been written. Yes, but I'll make it really complicated for you. You see, if you can kill somebody, you know, who's not halachically dead in order to take his organs, why can't you kidnap somebody if you have five people that you want to save and take this healthy person's organs? So, the halachic issue has been written about. I believe the Chazon Ish at one point had a suffix about something, a similar kind of case, but even he backed away. I think the very powerful consensus is that you're never, no matter how many people you would save, at least under ordinary rules of halacha, you cannot kill anybody via daim. The answer, the halachic answer to the trolley problem is that we are not consequentialist, we are deontological, and therefore murdering someone via daim is by definition worse than, you know, passively letting allow people to die. In other words, lo sirtzach is on a much higher level than lo samad adam re'echa, and therefore you don't do anything actively.
How come the statement hakam lo rigcha shkem v'orgel?
So that is the halacha. But the source for that would appear to be, well, there are actually two different things there. That's by Baba Machteris. That's its own discussion, but that's a separate. Baba Machteris is a unique case of the Rodef. It's totally different than a regular Rodef. By a regular case of Rodef, to be allowed to kill somebody, there has to be a clear presumption, absolutely clear the person is in the act of and trying to kill you. Baba Machteris is separate. Baba Machteris is a special chiddush of the Torah that even though you, number one, could back away and not stand in his way, not confront him, and number two, you haven't yet run into him, you're allowed to go and actively confront him, even if you don't know for sure that he would kill you, you're allowed to presume that he would, unless you know that he wouldn't. The Gemara draws the famous distinction between Av Hala Bein and Bein Hala Av. And parents, I think, all understand this, that the Rachmei Ha'av Ala Bein, that the love of a parent for a child is not generally the same as the love of a child for a parent. And therefore, if it's the father breaking in, the son is not allowed to kill his father because he can presume his father would never kill him. No matter how many times we tell our children, I want to kill you. Whereas if it's the son breaking in, the parent is allowed to kill the child because the assumption is the Rachmei Ha'bein Alav don't extend that way, and therefore he has the presumption of being a rodeh. So Baba Machteris is a separate category, but the regular case, and that's self-defense as opposed to a third party, here... this is the standard case of Rodef where a third party can step in, the Good Samaritan, and in this case, the Torah, and the source is from Narah HaMorasa. It's first understood by Ein Moshiala, HaYesh Moshia, he can be Moshia in any way that he can save her, and that is learned from there to a situation of a pursuer for murder that a third party can step in and kill the pursuer. Okay. So anyway, so the answer is I think the answer to the trolley problem is that in halacha is that lo sirtzach is on a much higher level than lo samad adam re'echa. You always can entertain the question of what we call aveira l'shma. It's a radical concept. It may get touched upon briefly in the sugya. I don't think we're going to look at that part of Tosfos. But there's a Gemara in Yevamos and I think in Nazir also, a parallel Gemara with a slight difference. It was yesterday's Haftarah. The story of Ya'el Eishes Chever Akeni. So the pshat and the psukim as we read them is that Ya'el took the 10 peg, she gave Sisra milk to drink, Sisra fell asleep, she took the 10 peg and she drove it through his head. But Chazal, in I can explain why they said what they said. They were very good readers. Chazal have a quite more elaborate and at least R-rated medrash on this particular issue. And the pasuk says the following: Bein in the poetry, not in the story, but in Dvorah's retelling, it says Bein Ragleha Karal Nafal. Shadud bein ragla karal nafal basher nafal basher shachav sham nafal shadud. I may have gotten a couple of verbs reversed. There are seven verbs in that pasuk, and there's also the expression bein ragleha. And the bein ragleha it creates a window for a sexual metaphor. Is that in order to kill Sisera, she felt she had to tire him out, and it says that she was nevelest him, she had beer with him seven times, and those are the seven verbs, and she wore him out that way, and then she was able to kill him. So the problem, of course, is that Yael was Yael, Eishes Chever Akeni. Number one. Number two, Sisera wasn't actually threatening her. He needed her for protection. So why did Yael do this? So in Chazal, they don't fully spell this out. But Chazal had this idea that she viewed him as a threat to Klal Yisrael, because if he escaped, what was he going to do? He was going to go raise another army and come back and threaten the Jewish people. And therefore, she violated Gilei Raios for the purposes of protecting Klal Yisrael. So now, the Gemara describes this as an Avera Lishma. Avera Lishma is obviously a very, very dangerous concept. Avera Lishma basically says that the means justify the ends. When we are Mechal Shabbos to save a person's life, it's not because of Avera Lishma. It's because the Torah says that you're Mechal Shabbos to save someone's life. But there are three Averas that you may not violate to save life, and yet Yael violated one of them. So there is this, in the trolley problem, you ask me if there's one person, on the track here and five there. What if it's 50? What if it's 500? What if it's 5,000? Does it reach the point where you would say Avera Lishma, and even though it's usher to do the thing, and I'm really violating an act of murder, the ends justify the means? But under ordinary circumstances, the answer is no. Okay. So with that, the central legal question that Halacha has to address, and the Gemara is sort of addressing it here, and it's often articulated more fully amongst the Achronim, is the question of when the Torah says ones rachmana patre, that the Torah exempted an ones based upon velanara lo sase davar. Does that mean that there's simply no punishment, but there is a mase avera, there's an element of sin here, just the person isn't culpable? Or does it mean there is no taint of avera whatsoever? Now you'll ask, Marshall.
Well, only because you just asked that exact question. 2 minutes ago you said you're allowed to be Mechal Shabbos to save someone's life.
Right.
That obviously presumes an answer to the question you just gave. In other words, do you see it, and I know we're not going to sidetrack into this, that you're allowed to be Mechal Shabbos to save someone's life, or is it that there is no Chilul Shabbos at all if you are engaged?
So that's a different question. That's a famous question of Hutra Dechuya. You choose those terms, but this is a step, everybody agrees, whether Hutra or Dechuya, everybody agrees you mechuyev to be Mechal Shabbos, right? There's no question about that. It's a mitzvah. And it's a big aver. I'm sorry. The words Hutra and Dechuya. The question is, when you have a conflict where one mitzvah pushes aside, let's say, an avera, a losase, is it that it is basically the Torah wipes away, it says there's no Shabbos here? Or is it that the Torah says there's Shabbos, but the mitzvah saseh of saving a life pushes it aside?
Define the words for me.
Hutra means literally permitted, undone, whereas Dechuya means pushed aside. Okay. It's still there, but it's pushed aside. So, but here, this is really going a step beyond that. Both of those would argue that only determines how far out of your way do you have to go to avoid the situation, right? The Gemara gives the example, the classic case is not by Shabbos, but by, I don't think the Gemara even explicitly discusses it by Shabbos. The Gemara discusses the question of whether something is Hutra or Dechuya by Tumah, in Karbanos. In other words, if all the Kohanim, by Karbanos, we say that Tumah is Hutra or Dechuya B'tzibur, that Karbanos Tzibur can be brought, with a Kohen who's Tameh. Now, I think when only one Kohen is Tameh, we wouldn't allow that. But let's say all the members of the family working that day were in fact Tameh. So the answer is you can bring the Karban, you should be able to bring the Karban Tamid, even though they're Tameim. Why? Because since the Karban has a fixed time, then we say, and almost all Karbanos Tzibur have a fixed time, therefore Tuma is Hutra B'Tzibur. What if you could just go to the next day's Mishmar, the next day's Beis Av, and ask them? So the Gemara suggests that whether you have to do that depends upon whether Tuma is Hutra or Dechuya. If you say that Tuma is Hutra B'Tzibur, then once the people right here who are supposed to do the Karbanos Tzibur are Tameh, you don't care. You don't have to go get anybody else. That's a bit Hutra.
By Hanukkah.
I don't want to touch that.
That's where they said you were allowed to.
There are more problems to deal with there. I don't want to touch
what's
the Chadak issue.
The basis of it.
So what's that?
The basis of Tumah Hitrubitzah. Yeah.
Whatever the source is, the Chuya means that you have to go get the other guys. Because, yes, you're allowed to, but it's only pushing it aside. And if you're able to avoid it, you do it. But either way, once you do it according to Halacha, there's no taint of Avera. Now, you'll ask me, what difference this Nara, you know, you do something, Be'ones, what difference does it make whether or not this taint of Avera? You're not punished for it, so it's really only an issue for God. So the following, there may be many more cases, but this is sort of the classic case in Lamdus that's presented. If I am a Chalal Shabbos, someone is Mechal Shabbos, and they get the death penalty. And then let's say the way they Mechal Shabbos is they burn your house down. So the halacha is that if at this very same moment that the Mechal Shabbos, and they burn your house down, they do the damage, so they're exempt from paying because of the principle of Kamalei B'derabim, you know, that we never cross category, whenever we have punishments from two categories, from death penalty, Malkos, and Mammon, you always get, if you have a punishment from two categories, you only get the more severe one. Okay, assuming that the incurring of the liability comes at the same time. So that's if I burn your house down and I get skila. What if I burn your house down on purpose, but I don't get skila? Or I burn it down b'shogeg. So the halacha is also, we still say kam le'bed rabim ne. The Gemara has a drasha, a famous Tana de Bechizkiya, to compare shogeg to mezid, that even if I burn your house, I think it's mutter to... I don't think it's mutter to burn your house down, but I think it's not malach on Shabbos. It's mutter to light a fire on Shabbos. So I burn somebody's house down on Shabbos, so I'm chayv to bring, I find that, oh, a terrible thing. It was such an aver that I did being mechal Shabbos, b'shogeg, not burning down your house. I have to bring a karban. Even if I don't get to bring the karban, I'm pater from having to pay. Why? Because even though I'm not liable, it's still the masa aver of chil Shabbos, and halacha tells you that I'm exempt. What happens if I burn your house down, let's say, b'misasek? I don't even realize, you know, like, I don't even realize that I'm about to step on the detonator that's going to blow your house up and start a fire on Shabbos. I do it effectively ba'ones. The question is, what's the din in that case? So if you believe that ones rachmana patre just means that there's no punishment, but there's the taint of avera, then I'm going to be exempt on Shabbos for doing so. Because normally, by mizikin, by damages, unless, no matter how accidental it is, I'm liable for damages. Even if, you know, I'm walking along and I just slip by accident and I destroy your property, you know, no matter how honest I am, I'm chayiv. But on Shabbos, if you believe that doing something, what it affects is ones, we would call it misasek on Shabbos, I'm not even intending to do anything. If you believe that there's a taint of avera, even though I'm not I don't even have to bring a karban, then I'm exempt from paying the damages. If you believe that no, because on Shabbos we say meleches machsheves asra Torah, Shabbos has a much higher threshold to violate Torah law, and therefore if I am a misasik, if I don't even realize what I'm doing, it's not only that I'm exempt, it's not even a masa avera, then I would be liable for doing the damage. So that's sort of one of the. But the larger question is, ones rachmana patre, is it an exemption only from punishment? Or is it an exemption, or is it actually a total wiping away of any taint? That's the question. Because that may have an impact on our discussion here. If somebody worships, you know, the Gemara is going to come up with the case of, let's say, someone forces you to worship your own animal. Right, so what's the status of the animal? Is it a nevad now, or is it not a nevad? All right, but in order to deal with the Gemara, and to deal with the only way to read the Gemara, so we have to now take our little detour. And let's start in the Sanhedrin. At least let's try to read the famous sugya about Yehoreg v'al-Yavor. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Mishum Rabbi Shimon ben Yehot Sadak. Nimnu v'gamru ba'aliyah space nitza b'lud. All the juicy stuff in Jewish history, in rabbinic history, takes place in Aliyah. And they're hiding out from somebody. I think the story in the Haggadah is, I thought it was, not in our Haggadah, the alternative story has them in somebody's Aliyah. That's where the good stuff happens. So, kol avera shebetorah. Im omrim la adam avor v'al tehoreg. If someone tells you violate it, and you won't be killed. And obviously, by contrast, if you don't violate it, I will kill you. Yavor v'al yehare, you should violate it and not give up your life. Chutz me'avodah zarah v'gilei arayos u'shfichos damim. Yavodah zarah is pretty straightforward. It only means actual worship of, well, it means worship of the Zara. Gilei Arayos refers to only incest and adultery. It doesn't refer to other sexual prohibitions, such as, let's say, a kohen and a grusha, as one example. Those all the prohibited marriages in the Torah that are not a function of relationship, but a function of some other thing. You know, it's kahuna, a mamzer. If someone puts a gun to your head and says, habia with this mamzeris, that's not Gilei Arayos. Gilei Arayos is specifically incest, as we would term it, nida, probably mishkav zachar, homosexuality, and adultery. Okay. All other isurei bia are isurei bia, they have their punishments, but they're not considered gilei rayos.
Not rape.
What's that?
Not rape.
Well, rape is not rape. Rape is status from the isur v'heter perspective, not from benon l'chavero, is determined by who the woman is. In other words, someone rapes a woman who he could have married in theory, so that, forgetting about what you do with this, the Torah's punishment is a financial punishment. In other words, it's nezek, it's pain, it's tsar, it's boshes, and sometimes if she was a psula, there's knas on top of it, right? But it's not treated as a it's not gilei arayos. It doesn't have the punishment of malchus and so on. And finally, shvichos damim. So now the Gemara says the following: avodah zarah lo, really avodah zarah? You don't violate avodah zarah to save your life. V'atanya amar Rabbi Yishmael, minayin shem amru lo adam avod avod dezara v'al tereg, minayin sheyavod v'al yehareg, tam alomar v'chai bohem v'lo sheyamus bohem. So if someone tells you, I'm going to kill you unless you worship avod dezara, Rabbi Yishmael says, you fulfill the mitzvah v'chai bohem and you worship the avod dezara. Yochal afilu b'farhesa, you might even think if he wanted you to worship avod dezara in public, it would be the same thing. Tam alomar v'lo sechalalu Hashem kotshi v'niktashti. So Rabbi Yishmael says that Avodah Zarah, there's a distinction between private and public. Rabbi Yishmael's position is so obviously intuitive for a very simple reason. Worshipping Avodah Zarah, by definition, requires intent. No one can make you actually worship Avodah Zarah against your will. They can get you to utter words. They can say that Baal is my God. They can get you to say that, but you don't actually mean it, right? And therefore, what does it mean to force somebody to worship Avodah Zarah? To force them, if they bow, you can bow down in front of an idol in order to collect your money that fell on the ground. So you're not supposed to do that. We learned early in the Masechta, Kusamar Asayin. But if you bowing down on the ground without intent to worship the idol is not actually Avodah Zarah. So if you think about it, there really is no such thing as genuine Avodah Zarah ba'ones. So then why is it that you're not allowed to do it? So Rabbi Yishmael says, because of Chilul Hashem. Because it looks, precisely because it looks like you're worshiping Avodah Zarah, it's prohibited. And thus, Rabbi Yishmael draws a distinction between public and private. Yeah. That's Rabbi Yishmael's position. So the question is, how do you make that work with Rabbi Yochanan's position? Rabbi Yochanan said, Avodah Zarah, you always give up your life. So the Gemara says, Inhu de Amor Karabi Eliezer. Rabbi Yochanan, and name of Shema, it's Ben Yotzadok, they hold like the opinion of Rabbi Eliezer, the Tanya, Rabbi Eliezer, Omer. V'yahavta eis Hashem Elokecha b'chol levavcha b'chol nafshecha b'chol modecha. Im nemar b'chol nafshecha, lama nemar b'chol modecha. V'im nemar b'chol modecha, lama nemar b'chol nafshecha. The Torah says you have to love God. Forget for the moment what b'chol levavcha is. B'chol nafshecha, with your entire being, your entire life, and with all of your money. Ma'odecha. So why does the Torah have to tell us both? So the Gemara says, Im yesh lacha adam shechaviv shegufo chavo lab mimono. That's why, if there's a person, you would hope most people are like that, whose life is more important to him than his money, so then lekachdem or b'chol nafshecha, you have to give up even your life. Then yesh lecha adam, whose values are a little out of whack, shemamono chav v'olam yigufo, lekachdem or b'chol mahodecha. As an aside, Mershechter once quoted, I think it was Chaim Yivalashin, asked the question, why in the first parasha of Shema it says, b'chol levavcha b'chol nafshecha b'chol mahodecha. In the second parasha, V'hayim Shemoa, it says, V'chol levavchem v'chol nafshechem, but it doesn't say, U'v'chol me'odchem. Why doesn't it say that? So I think the quote of Chaim V'Lashon said that it's possible to find an individual whose priorities are warped, and that he or she values his or her money more than his or her life. And therefore, the Torah has to tell you both b'chol nafshecha, which is what's for normal people, and b'chol modecha. But it's inconceivable that an entire community's values are so warped that they can't understand that they're protecting their lives is more important than protecting their property, and therefore the Torah only needs to tell you u'v'chol nafshecha. Okay. So anyway, so therefore, lekach neimar b'chol ma'odecha. So basically, this is love. What is loving God? Loving God is worshiping God and not worshiping anybody else. According to Rabbi Eliezer, there is no distinction. It's not a function primarily chil Hashem. It's a sign of avas Hashem somehow that under no circumstances would you give anybody the impression, not just the public, but even the private individual, the sense that you are worshiping another God. Okay, and then gilei ra'is or shvichos damim. How do we know gilei ra'is and shvichos damim? And this is for everybody. Kid the Rebbe, the Tanya Rebbe Omer. The Torah draws the comparison between the Nara Hamorasa who was raped in the field and the person who was murdered by his fellow human being. What do you learn from Rotzeach? What exactly is the Torah telling you here? It's coming to teach something, and then it ends up learning something. Makish Rotzeach l'Nara Hamorasa. First, it compares Rotzeach to Nara Hamorasa. Ma Nara Hamorasa nitan latzilo benafsho. Af Rotzeach nitan latzilo benafsho. Just as a Nara Hamorasa, you're allowed to save the Nara Hamorasa by killing the person, or may, strange as this may sound, you're allowed to save the rapist from performing the Avera by killing him. So too, Afrotzeach nitan lahatzilo benafsho. You're allowed to save him from committing the Avera by killing him. Umakish nara hamorasa lerotzeach, and it's also a reverse comparison. Ma rotzeach yehareg v'al yavor, af nara marasa tehareg v'al tavor. So too, by nara marasa. Now, it's very interesting that the expression "my nara marasa" is tehoreg v'al tavor. This is actually the subject of a major dispute, a major, major dispute that we're going to explore. But it sounds like that in principle, the nara marasa is also tehoreg v'al tavor. She too has to let herself be killed rather than violate an avera. Now, this is a little strange because, after all, what happened in this case? She did violate the avera. Now the answer to that, for the moment, the answer to that question is yes, but it wasn't that the rapist gave her a choice, either allow me to rape you or going to kill you. He just forcibly raped her. So it's not that she had a choice between her life and violating the Avera, she actually physically had no choice. But we're going to come back to this question. I believe Rashi himself already writes here that the Gir says Yehari Ve'al Yavor, and is a very, very famous Tosis that we're going to look at, it's later on the sheets, that depends upon who this line is being addressed to. But for the moment, let's just leave it as such. Just as Avodah Zarah is Yehari Gal Yavar, so too Gilei Arayus is Yehari Gal Yavar. Ah, but Rotzeach Gufei Minalon, how do you know that a Rotzeach, you're not allowed to, that it's Yehari Gal Yavar? Svarahu. Da'ahuda Asa Lekame, it's a Svar. Da'ahuda Asa Lekame Derabah, V'amar Lei. Somebody came in front of the Rabbah and said to him, Amar li mari duroi, the master of my place, meaning the town bully, came and said, Zil katli leplanya, go kill so-and-so. V'ilo katlina lach, if not, I'm going to kill you. Amar le, Rabba said to him, lichtaluch velo tiktul. Let him kill you, and you may not murder. Mi'emar didama didach sumak tfei, who says that your blood is redder. Dilma dama dahu gavra sumak tfei, maybe his blood is redder than yours. Okay, so that's the first step. So the Gemara comes to the following conclusion. There are three averas that you have to give up your life for rather than violate. Gilei ra'is, avodah zarah, and shvichos damim. But avodah zarah is a machlokes whether or not it applies only in public or it applies even in private. But now the Gemara goes further. Ki osa ravdini amar Rabbi Yochanan lo shanu ela b'shalo b'shas hashmad. This is only true that you may violate every mitzvah in the Torah if it is not a time of the persecution of the Jewish people, the persecution of Torah. Aval b'shas hashmad, when it's a time of persecution, afilu mitzvah kala yehari v'ayavar. Even on a small mitzvah, you have to give up your life. Why is that so? The assumption is because it's also a question of chilul Hashem. Right? Ordinarily speaking, the guy may have whatever reasons he wants you to violate X. So we say it's better that you survive and you violate the Avera. But if it's a time of persecution, so then it's a totally different game. Now, to do anything, to yield on anything, is a chilul Hashem. It looks like you're denying, Judaism.
It makes no difference if it's in public or in private.
It makes no difference in public or private.
It's just a pretext.
Well, no, because it's...
The small Avera.
Yes, but the assumption, if the guy was going to kill you anyway, nobody would do the Avera. But the assumption is he might actually not kill you. You give him the pleasure, the satisfaction that he made you be over Aldas, which we'll see more in a moment. So, Amar, but, Ki Asa, Ravin Amar Rabbi Yochanan Afilu Shelo B'Shas Hashmad Lo Amur Ela B'Tzina Avo B'Farhesya Afilu Mitzvah Kala Yehareg B'Yavar. So Rabbi Yochanan comes further and says that even Shelo B'Shas Hashmad, the only time you're allowed to violate an Aveira is when it's done privately, not publicly. The Gemara is going to qualify that in a moment. But for the moment, leave that state. So now, my Mitzvah Kala, what is a Mitzvah Kala? Amar Rav Bar Yitzchak Amar Rav Afilu L'Shanuye Arkisa D'Misana. Arkisa de Misana is actually, those who study Targum know this phrase from Chumash, it's the translation of Sroch Na'al. When Avram said, Michut V'Yad Sroch Na'al, Sroch Na'al is an Arkisa de Misana. Misana is a shoe and Arkisa is a strap. The question is, what exactly is Arkisa de Misana? Is a Machlokas HaRishonim. Not surprisingly, in Ashkenaz, they thought Arkasa the Misana meant even the smallest minhag. If the Jews, you know, happen to, you know, if it's even a minhag of anything, it's Yehari V'Yavar. The Rambam, I think, understands, no, Arkas of the Masana is an Isur Daraisa, it's Chukos HaGoyim. It was some kind of a shoe strap that only the Goyim wore. It was, well, however you define Chukos HaGoyim, it was a violation of Isur Daraisa of Chukos HaGoyim. Even though it's not, there's no Misa, there's no Kares, nonetheless, B'Shas HaShmad, even on a small lav, you have to give up your life. Yes, Marshall?
I don't really understand conceptually Rabbi Yochanan's position at all, because Shad Hashmad makes good sense to me. In other words, Judaism itself is threatened. We're taking a stand. You know, watching the edifice crumble can lead to the destruction of the Halachic society and all that. But if it's not Shad Hashmad and there's just some horrible, you know, gang or town bully, and they pull Lenny off the street by his hair and they say, eat this, you know, hamburger or we're going to kill you, and it has to be a Farhesia. It's known to be duress. It's, in other words, the whole concept of there being only three mitzvahs becomes a joke if the minute there are nine Jews in any context, and or nine or ten plus you, whatever.
Right.
I don't understand the svara behind it.
So the assumption, the Gemara is going to ultimately qualify this and say, it's only true in public if the purpose of the guy is lavur el das. If the purpose was to, in other words, if the guy, if you know how to change a tire, and his tire is broken, and he sees you walking by, and he says, you know, please help me change the tire. He said, I can't, it's my Shabbos. He pulls out his gun and says, change my tire. Nah. So he's not doing lavur el das. He does it because he wants to change the tire. But if it's done with the kavana of lavur el das, so then already becomes a chil Hashem. Right? That's kind of like Shas Hashmad on a small scale. It's not, in other words, so...
It's not
quite the same thing as Shas Hashmad, but the idea is that it's still chil Hashem. Right, in other words, when the guy makes you do it to change your tire, it's not that he made a Jew be mechal Shabbos in tire. He pulled some guy off the street who was coming in who could change his tire. But when he does it just to make you mechal Shabbos, then that, and it's public, so that becomes a statement that my God's, your God's impotent, and look what I'm going to do. I'm going to make you violate your God's word.
I think he's talking about like a pogrom. It's an episode where they go
actually Dafka,
not
pogrom. Right. It's not a theological issue. Could be, for example, not to change my tire. It could just be some atheist in a gang who thinks this is all funny.
I am
Jews by their beards and make them eat cheeseburgers.
Right. So then the question becomes actually the question. I don't know that the Rishonim described this because they didn't know of such a world. Is there such a thing? No, I could hear one distinguishing between, you know, I'd call it a Christian or a Muslim who's a from Christian Muslim. He's going to show right, as opposed to some bully who just likes to, who would do it to anybody. He's not doing it because he's trying to show the triumph of his God. Yeah, right. So it could be that that's not called lavur el das. Right, it's possible. And it's possible you have to define exactly where it is. But I think for Chazal, likely didn't actually see such a category. Much firmer world.
It's before Spinoza.
Right. Okay. Much firmer world.
There's a Rav Ashri has a tshuva, if I recall. You know.
Anyways, yeah, Mimalakin.
So the question is, when they captured American POWs, the first thing the Germans would ask is, "Who are the Jews?"
Right.
And he says, now the guy didn't come forward and say he was a Jew, because that's a question of Moral Das, because he's denying, you know, his religion.
But
I mean, he raises the whole question.
I can, but based upon the sugya, you can answer why a person doesn't have to do that.
No, I think it comes out that
you're going to, on the basis of sugya, you'll know why, because karka olam is going to be the end. You're passive. It's the difference between doing something versus not doing something. We'll come back then. Okay. So anyway, and then finally, we'll close with this. V'kama parhesya, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Amar Yaakov, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Ein Parhesia Prusa, Me'asar Ben Adam. It has to be at least 10 people. And then the Gemara says, well, we'll talk about a few more of the details, okay? But we'll, God willing, we'll pick up with this next Sunday. And then eventually we're going to get back to our sugya and see why this is so important for the sugya of Nevad. Okay.
The public is 10?
The public is 10.